I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back for another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we will dive back into golf course architecture and we are joined by Riley Johns. Riley is an up-and-coming architect from Canada who recently completed his first solo design with Keith Reb at Winter Park and has worked under great architects such as Tom Doak, Bill Corr, Ben Crenshaw, and Rod Whitman. Riley, welcome on.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of your up-and-coming success as a professional podcaster.
I don't know about that. After the intro music, it takes a sharp decline. So I'd love to, you know, I think a lot of people probably aren't familiar with your name, but would love to hear a little bit about your background, how you got into golf course design, and a little bit about you.
Well, you know, I kind of came from, I'm Canadian, obviously, so, you know, golf is a big part of our, you know, our country up here, along with other sports like hockey, but, you know, I kind of came from a different side of things. I came from more of a construction background rather than, you know, I was never the kid that was drawing, you know, golf holes on the back of his, you know, restaurant placemat. You know, I never, you know, my father was never a member at a prestigious club, and so I never really had a, you know, a golf-centric kind of background. I came from more of a, you know, I love the outdoors. You know, I was always the kid that, you know, we never had TV or anything like that. We, you know, we'd go outside and play. We'd build forts out in the forest. And, you know, I was pretty lucky to grow up in a town, mountain town in Canada, right next to, you know, Banff. And it's a beautiful part of the country. So, you know, I spent a lot of time outdoors and, you know, we, you know, I was always the kid that was, that we'd have a sandbox, right? And we had Tonka toys and we'd shape things with the sand and build, you know, our version of a big hydro dam and get the garden hose and fill it up to the brim and, you know, breach the hydro dam and watch the sandbox flood and, you know, do those kind of things. So, you know, that's kind of how I grew up, and a lot of my summer jobs included outdoor, you know, type work, whether it be landscaping or land surveying, or golf course maintenance or ski lift construction, or even, you know, a lot of civil kind of, you know, outdoor civil projects. And so, you know, I was never, you know, other than being the ball boy picking up golf balls and doing golf course maintenance, I was never really part of golf until later on in my life. And it was when I was doing golf course maintenance that I realized that, you know, I really enjoyed golf as a sport, but also the whole design aspect and the strategy that came along with it, and just the whole, you know, golf as being a you know, something that neat, you know, as a development. Like, that was one thing I, you know, never thought of as a kid growing up either, was, you know, I didn't know there was even a profession out there called golf course architecture, golf course design. That was something I just never thought of until I remember we were land surveying a golf course here in my hometown. My dad was a land surveyor, so I, you know, worked with him quite a bit, and we're surveying, you know, a golf course. And this was before GPS and, you know, all that fancy technology now that you could pretty much do it from the computer. We had to go out in the into the forest, into the bush, and, you know, cut a cut line so he could get the shot. And I remember cutting this cut line, and, you know, about 200 yards down, he said, okay, now move the stake over to the left. Okay, now put that in the ground. Now right down the eighth green, right? And I'm here in the middle of the forest and going, what? Eighth green right here? This doesn't make any sense. And that was kind of an aha moment for me as far as, wow, golf is a big development, and there's people that, you know, are fundamental in the creation of golf, and it's something that needs to be created. So, you know, I went on to working for, you know, various golf course related entities, whether it be, you know, doing golf course maintenance. You know, I worked actually at a golf course here in town where I worked on the maintenance crew in the morning, and then I worked in the kitchen at night. And so I was working, you know, 12-hour days, getting up early and staying late, and just kind of lived at the golf course for an entire season. So it was an interesting, you know, kind of interesting aspect to being involved in a golf course where you can kind of see the operations from all different different angles was, you know, that was pretty interesting too. And, you know, as I, you know, decided to kind of take this, you know, a little bit further, I, you know, sent some resumes out and got on a golf course contractor team and started building golf in the Calgary area, you know, just picking rocks on a fairway, you know, like there's no glorious path to any of this, and I don't even know if there's a right or wrong. I'm sure as you interview more people, you realize that everyone's kind of taking their own, you know, path to get to where they went, and mine was a very hands-on, you know, construction path. And, you know, working for a golf contractor just really opened my eyes to, you know, what is actually involved in creating golf, and how much goes into it, how many people are involved, and all the nuances involved in that. And I also had fantastic, you know, access to some seasoned professionals and architects and a variety of, you know, people in the industry who, you know, mentored me and educated me and taught me. And, you know, before you know it, I was 17 years old and sitting in a dozer and, you know, pushing dirt, and fell in love with it from that day and started shaping and doing some finishing work. I learned drainage. I worked for irrigation contractors. I can, you know, install irrigation. So I just kind of learned as much as I could about golf and golf course design and construction, you know, reading golf course architecture books, you know, while shaping on a project, you know, while, you know, picking people's brains on, you know, questions that I had, and having access to those kind of people was critical. And, you know, a lot of them were very supportive and, you know, suggested that I, you know, had a knack for it and that I could take it, you know, to the next level and, you know, keep pursuing it, and encouraged me to basically, you know, go to school was kind of the next step. You know, I'd worked on dozens of projects, you know, whether they were brand new builds or renovations or restorations or remodels or what have you. And you know, learning architecture from books and that kind of stuff is good, but, you know, it has its, you know, limitations as far as what you can get out of it. And so, you know, I enrolled in the University of Guelph's landscape architecture program with the intent or the focus of kind of concentrating on golf and golf design and golf architecture and, you know, and any sort of engineering, anything that, you know, I took turf science as kind of a minor and just kind of pieced together, you know, an education that I thought would be beneficial going forward. And it was fantastic. It was, you know, I learned so much in that 4 years of, you know, things that I just wouldn't be able to kind of pull from a book, and I was able to use my experience that I've got, you know, that I already had, you know, 10 years of shaping and building golf, so I mean, things, you know, and having a land surveying background as well, just, you know, I felt like I had a pretty good understanding of, you know, spatial analysis and 3D and development and, you know, contours and grading and all that stuff was, you know, pretty natural to me by that point. So I was able to focus my studies more on some of the, you know, the meat potatoes or kind of the nuances of design and learn, you know, learn theories on, you know, whether it be, you know, conceal and reveal or prospect refuge or, you know, any sort of kind of landscape architecture theories. And then I started kind of looking at that through the lens of golf course architecture. And I started to find a lot of similarities in how golf course architecture and landscape architecture, where they met and where they differed. And, you know, I was able to kind of learn on a deeper level, I suppose, kind of what I wanted to get out of university. And so, you know, that was fantastic. You know, I just paid my way through university through shaping. So I was kind of just immersed in golf course and golf course design for a long time. And then, you know, trying to get to the next level, you know, I don't have the luxury of having a father who is a golf course architect or a professional golfer or anything like that. So, you know, the next step was to hound Tom Doak and ask him if he would ever consider, you know, taking me on as an intern. And that took about 3 years of letter writing. And he finally said, you know what, we've got some projects on the go in China and a few domestically, just could be the right time. So, you know, I jumped on that opportunity
I've heard that Tom has a application process for the internship where you kind of do a design. Was that the case when you got into the program?
Yes. I remember doing a design. He had like some contour maps and you do a design I don't even know if there was an official application process when I did it. It was more of a, you know, Traverse City was, you know, driving from out west where I live to, you know, Guelph, Ontario, which is in Toronto, basically. You know, I was kind of going through his neighborhood, so I'd stop by his office and hang out and introduce myself kind of face-to-face sort of thing. So I don't know if I did the application process properly, but it was more of a, you know, how's it going? My name's Riley. If there's ever an opportunity to, you know, work with you guys or learn from you, I would very much like that sort of thing. So, yeah, I do remember some sort of contour map and you came up with a designer, but I remember that was kind of very early. That was maybe the first time I contacted him. He had something like that on his website. But, spent a year with him and the Renaissance guys, which was, you know, outstanding. I did a little work out in China with Eric Iverson out there. And but for the most part, you know, I was really just looking for the office experience and you know, trying to learn the business side of the profession. You know, I had enough dozer time and excavator time and, you know, enough golf courses kind of under my belt as far as construction and implementation. But the one thing that you just have a tough time learning about in this industry is, you know, how to write a consulting report or, you know, how to structure a contract or, you know, how do you go, you know, how do you, you know, all the kind of, you know, business accounting and you know, structuring a company and just like there's so many things that, you know, you just can't learn from a book or school, and you can only learn by, you know, kind of placing yourself in into a situation or working with someone who's done it. And Tom was extremely open and accommodating and generous. And I spent a lot of time in the Traverse City office helping him with, you know, plans and going on consulting trips with him out to, you know, Long Island and you know, golfing with him at Crystal Downs and being able to, you know, really have a lot of one-on-one time with him and also being, you know, in the den, so to speak, when, you know, phone calls are happening and, you know, trying to figure out budgets and, you know, working on, you know, time construction timelines and, you know, getting phone calls from clients and helping with, you know, writing up reports and stuff like that. So that was kind of what I was really looking to get in to do. As unglamorous as a lot of people may think that is, that's like that's a hard thing to learn in this industry, and it was so important. He was so open, and it was a big you know, kind of piece filled the gap, so to speak, from all my other kind of education.
So I'm curious with Tom, you know, in having spent so much time with Tom, what you think is kind of, you know, if you had to look at one thing that he does just extremely well and maybe, you know, the best, you know, of the modern era at one aspect of design, what would you say it is?
You know, I would say he, you know, being, he's very mathematical, very analytical too. I would say routing. He's very, you know, and I think that's what really interests him in the profession too, is the solving or cracking of the puzzle, you know, and then also creating a puzzle at the same time, you know, which is kind of the art or the craft of, you know, golf course architecture. You get this land and you get these contours and you get all these, you know, views and constraints and, you know, all these kind of pieces to a puzzle that you then need to kind of analyze and then come up with the best solution, you know, for that piece of land with, you know, the intention of, you know, you have some constraints like, you know, golf is 18 holes typically and, you know, 7,000 yards is a pretty average number for, you know, that. And, you know, you want a variety of par threes and fours, but for the most part, you could put, you know, you could route that golf course a million different ways on that one piece of land. And, you know, I think he really relishes that kind of challenge. And you know, working with him on the Forest Dunes project, you know, being able to, you know, sit in the office and watch and learn and work with him on how routing of a golf course, not in just one direction, but two directions, you know, that was like a... I was a master's class in routing sort of thing. So, you know, he's very, you know, when it comes to routing, he's very, you know, an example is when he's tallying up his, you know, yardages or, you know, wants to see what the par ends up being, you know, I'm the next generation that pulls out a calculator, but he just looks at it and he can just crunch all those numbers and say, yeah, 6,872 yards sort of thing. You're like, holy smokes, okay.
Yeah. So I know. So well, I know you got into.
Yeah, and routing is a bit of a mathematical game too when you get into the core of it. But I would say that's his, you know, what he enjoys doing the most and what he's one of the best in the world at mm-hmm. doing.
So you've referenced, you know, reading books a couple times, and a question I get all the time is, you know, what are your favorite architecture books? And I'm curious what you think are some of the best architecture books, whether it's for a beginner or for somebody that's, you know, gotten through all of the, you know, the introductory materials.
There's so many out there now, and there's so much resources that, you know, and being able to purchase books now is so easy, and, you know, Google and Amazon. So, you know, my library is a little bit overgrown, is one way of putting it. But, you know, there's one book that for beginners, like a lot of people ask me the same question, and it's like, well, you don't want to get into, you know, too heavy of stuff right out of the gate, because it's kind of, you know, probably boring for most people. But, you know, to get a sense of golf course architecture, and but also have some visuals to kind of go along with it. There's a book that it was Jeff Shackelford did it with Michael Miller, the painter, the artist, and it's called The Art of Golf Design, and it's kind of a coffee table book, but, you know, it's got a lot of good information in there. It just kind of has a real nice way of explaining golf course architecture, its features, its principles, its theories, its, you know, and also gives some great examples of, you know, it in practice. But they also do this cool thing where they take, you know, they take images, or they try to recreate what the golf course used to look like and then paint it. So, like, you can find, like, pictures of, you know, Pine Valley and the, you know, mid-1920s, and they'll do a, you know, a depiction of it. You know, Michael Miller would do a sweet picture of it with the, you know, paintings and clouds, and just animate it and bring it to life. And then Jeff Shackelford does his, like, essays on, you know, what the, you know, some of these finer features of golf course architecture are, like, you know, temptation, you know, just try to get into it, but not overwhelming. So, you know, anyone that's kind of interested in golf course architecture but doesn't want to pick up a novel,
yeah,
and also wants to look at some cool pictures, I would say the Art of Golf Design is a good starter.
Uh-huh.
And then for something that's a little bit heavier, you know, one book that I always liked, and it's not really heavier, but it's the Golf Has Never Failed Me, the Donald Ross book. I don't know if you have that one, if you read it, but
I haven't. I'm gonna get that one. I've outgrown my bookshelf, so my fiance might kill me. But
it's a good one. It's like, it's kind of, they've taken a bunch of notes or almost like diary type entries from Donald Ross and just pieced it together. It's kind of like an eclectic notebook of Donald Ross, and he just talks about just everything, really, everything from turf to design to construction to his opinions on things, you know, golf related, whether that's, you know, attire or mannerisms, and it's just kind of fascinating little book that's quick to pick up. You don't have to sink into it, like, they're all segregated into small little chapters, and some of them are only a page long, sort of thing. And, you know, I just always like the way those guys wrote and spoke back in the day. Like, they had a way of saying, you know, their quotes are amazing. They had a way of saying things in one sentence that, you know, in this day and age, it seems like we have to use a paragraph to say the exact same thing. And they just had this witty kind of, you know, way of just making their point. You know, I'm sure you've come across a lot of them and seen a lot of quotes. They could summarize things so beautifully and succinctly, and who knows, maybe that's also transcended into their golf course design, the less is more kind of model, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they had like a good little snark to them too, you know, where and that's something I always like, is, you know, reading the old quotes, and, you know, these guys had so much more attitude, and in today's era, their quote would just get mangled and just, you know, picked apart. But back then, they could, you know, they could just land blast things. And I mean, in general, I think that writing short and concise is a lot harder than writing, you know, long. I think it's definitely an art. So, you know, I think you've got a really interesting background and unique background that got you into the game, and you know, it might not be the typical path to architecture, but, you know, doing maintenance and learning about turf and having early experience with construction, it's had to have helped you a ton. And I know that you are of like the design build nature. Like, how much of an advantage do you think your background has given you in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess it's an advantage. It's a you know, I certainly rely on it heavily when doing design work or, you know, coming up with ideas. It's super helpful to have the wherewithal or ability to not just design something, but to know exactly how to achieve it, how to actually build it, how it, you know, what's feasible and what's not. I feel like I have a pretty good sense. It's very intuitive now, right? And I think that's maybe, you know, what helps me the most is just to be able to understand, you know, from having mowed greens to, what the limitations of a greens mower is, or what the limitations of a fly mow is when it comes to, say, maintaining, you know, steep faces, or, you know, what the implications of sand splashed up on a bunker face is in a rainy climate and having washouts and, you know, all that stuff. So I think it really does help me, actually. And I think it just really helps create a fuller picture of the design work that at hand, and it just helps inform a lot of the design decisions, and I find it's going to definitely help, you know, in the future. I'm very thankful and glad that I had the opportunity to learn a lot of these, you know, from a lot of these seasoned professionals on techniques, whether that's, you know, understanding how an irrigation head is wired, to why, you know, pipe sizes need to be a certain size, you know, to get water pressure, you know, efficiently from one side of the site to the other, and, you know, all those kind of, all those things that perhaps if you were never in the trenches doing it, you might not even have an understanding on how that works or why, and who knows, maybe had you had that kind of background or knowledge, you might have designed something slightly different. Not that I'm saying design should definitely be, you know, form and function and all that debate, but there's definitely something there that's helpful, and I think it just, for me, it boils down to a bit more of an intuitive kind of feel to how golf courses function after you're done building them.
I imagine that a golf course is, you know, when you design it, you're kind of designing almost like it's like an animal, and where, you know, all the parts need to work together. And, you know, if one of them doesn't work, it never will live up to what, you know, it originally was intended for.
Yeah, but, you know, you can also, you know, fall in the trap of overthinking things, overanalyzing them, and, you know, sometimes mistakes are what breathe life to the character of a golf course too. You know, unintended mistakes could very well turn to bode well for a golf hole or golf course or whatever it might be, and just, you know, it's not like it's a skyscraper or a bridge or a highway or something, you know, something of that's that has life at stake or anything like that, but it's, you know, it's golf's it's a fluid process, and it's a living, breathing, you know, entity once you're done with it, and it evolves over time with the, you know, the elements, and sometimes trying to, you know, the hubris of trying to think that you can figure it all out and control that, you know, you might be handcuffing, you know, the potential of a golf course or golf hole by trying to control all those elements. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, and you'll talk to anyone in the industry who's been doing this for a while, like, sometimes mistakes or unintended, you know, things that happen on a golf course inspire, you know, you'll leave it, or you get inspired to, you know, maybe you use that to, you know, we're gonna shape off of that. You know, funny, sometimes, you know, things like an irrigation blowout, if a mainline blows out and it carves this huge chasm and, you know, on the side of the fairway, and you go back to the tee and you're like, hey. And this has happened to, and I'm sure a lot of people out there had similar situations happen like this. But, you know, an irrigation break could turn into a cool cross bunker pretty quick.
Right? It's like almost anything. Sometimes your biggest, you know, I make mistakes all the time, and sometimes they work out. So I know you, it seems like you're pretty well read, and I'm curious with, you know, what golden age architects have you studied the most and kind of have the most appreciation for? Maybe some that are, you know, obviously everybody loves Mackenzie, but you know, some off the beaten path names that you know, not every casual golf fan knows.
Well, that's a tough question. The reason that those guys are so popular is because they were, you know, they put a lot of their thoughts and theories and principles and all that stuff into writing, and a lot of them were quite sound. So, I mean, you know, I've taken a lot from different architects and tried to piece together kind of my own eclectic, you know, theories and ideas and stuff like that. But, you know, I would say, not that he's obscure by any means, but Stanley Thompson up here in Canada is a big, big influence for me, especially being a, you know, a member and next door to the Banff Springs Golf Course, and, you know, having seen and played that, you know, pretty much my whole life. And, you know, I would say Stanley Thompson had a big influence. I think he's pretty underrated too. I don't know, you know, if he's just overshadowed by the Mackenzies and the Rosses and the Colts and the McDonalds and all that, but he, you know, he was pretty groundbreaking in his ideas, and, you know, kind of there was a bit of a parallel universe kind of happening up here as those guys were, you know, finding their stride and starting to really push the profession and you know, discover and experiment and all that. He was doing the same thing up here, and he built some amazing golf courses, and, you know, he thought really deeply about design and wrote about it. You know, for instance, I remember seeing this, and I don't even know where I've seen this. It's like a graph, and Stanley Thompson drew this graph. This is probably, you know, 1920s. And the graph kind of is his attempt at explaining ebbs and flow of a round, of a routing, and how, you know, it's kind of like music, how there's, you know, there's a peak and there's, you know, there's an introduction and you know, you don't want to make it too hard out of the gate sort of thing. And, you know, where to put the par fives and the threes so that the course, the routing has a flow to it that is harmonious with either the land or the type of golfer that's going to golf it or what have you. And I thought that was pretty groundbreaking, not just to think about it, but also then to attempt to put it into some sort of, you know, visuals that he could then communicate it to others. You know, I thought that was pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the round is, you know, kind of like a song where, you know, all the great songs have some sort of a bill. Like, you know, it can start out strong and then, but there's always like a lull or, you know, some aspect of it. There has to be, you know, contrast for a golf course to be great. You know, if you know, hard, every hole being a ball buster is nothing anybody wants, but, you know, a course that's filled with, you know, short par fours also, you know, you want variety and you want different things. So it's pretty interesting to think of how he, you know, kind of tried to come up with a formula, like a, you know, some sort of put it into context. I'm interested, you know, I've stumbled across this question and, you know, I've been asked it a few times. What do you think about the role of the first hole of a golf course? Because it seems like, you know, there's differing logic where some people think it should be, you know, a like a warm handshake. Like, I think it was Rayner said that it should be, you know, a friendly opening hole. I think Ross was that belief. But then there are others that think that it should be representative of the course to come. And, you know, you find these, you know, a lot more challenging first holes. You know, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, you know, it's like, it's tough to you know, paint every golf course with one overriding theory, right? That's, you know, as you know, the variety is just key in golf, and you know, if you opened every golf hole with a warm handshake, then you're getting rid of variety, right? So, you know, Stanley Thompson also spoke of it. You know, he was a proponent of the par five, you know, starting off. And there's a couple different ways you can look at it, I think. I think the one is more of a logistics point of view, right? It's you don't want to have a log jam on your golf course, you know, after the first hole. You don't want to make it a difficult, you know, long hole with, say, water and hazards and opportunity to lose your golf ball, and then follow that up with a, you know, a par three that's notoriously, you know, three putts. So it's like right out of the gate, you've designed a 1-2 punch that is going to start everyone's round slow. And so, you know, that has nothing to do with anything other than you've designed, it's inherent now in that golf course. So it is important, but would you sacrifice a good golf hole for the sake of it being, you know, should it be a four? Should it be a five? Should it be a long five? Should it be an easy five? Should it be, you know, all those things? I think it's really site specific, but you know, if you twisted my rubber arm and obviously starting with a par three, not that it's that it's uncommon, but it's out there. You know, I wouldn't start a golf course with a par three. You know, a par four, par five, I think is preferable. I like the par five starting because it just gets the golfer out into the property quicker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a short five, you know, gives a guy an opportunity to get an eagle right out of the gate. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm all about fun golf and the experience of golf. And if someone can start their round with a birdie, what's more fun than that?
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about you and Keith Rebb's project down at Winter Park, where you guys teamed up to do each of your first solo work, as I believe. And you took, you know, basically a municipal 9-hole course. It's I went and played it a couple months ago. It's a great, great little course. It's, short as 2,400 yards, but you really gave it a big facelift. And I think it serves as a good model for, you know, the future of municipal golf with, you know, interesting green complexes and great bunkering work. But I'm curious about, you know, venturing off and doing, you know, what was the thing that, you know, you learned most from doing something on your own for the first time?
You know, you learned a lot. You learned a lot. It's not a... I just say one thing. We were quite lucky. I mean, we surrounded ourselves with the right team, which I think, you know, we kind of always knew that was critical for any project is the guys that you bring on to it. So, you know, we'd learned that from other projects, thankfully. So we didn't make any mistakes with that. I mean, everyone that was involved in that project was the right guy for the job, and we just had such a good time building it. I would say working and also being a foreigner working on that project, right? There was another level, added to it for me at least. Navigating the municipal, I don't know if bureaucracy is the right word, but just the corridors of getting a project like this off the ground. So everything from, you know, permitting, approvals, having to explain and come up with designs to help communicate to people that are in, you know, the municipal government who are not necessarily golfers and look at this as just a, you know, an infrastructure type project, right? So it's not like you're dealing with a client who is all about golf and loves golf and is golf, and you understand, you know, you had to almost, you almost had to explain very simple ideas that you almost assume most people would know, but when you're working with a municipality, I mean, they're working on all sorts of different projects, right? And they've created a committee to look at the golf course, right? Just like they create a committee to, you know, revitalize the museum or the library, right? It's not necessarily these people are, you know, golf fanatics. So, you know, navigating, you know, the municipal ropes or avenues or whatever you want to call it, and also educating the people who were ultimately hiring us on why we were doing things. I would say that was, you know, the biggest thing we learned. And, you know, everything from, like, even things like insurance and bonding and, you know, like this, the very unglamorous part of this industry or this profession is, you know, all that stuff matters. And, you know, we had to learn it and learn it quick. And there was no room to kind of stumble on something. So that was a quick learn for sure.
What would you say about that project? Were you most proud of walking away, whether it's a, you know, a specific feature or, you know, just a, you know, something that, you know, occurred while you guys were on site?
I would say it was just the teamwork and how we did it. I mean, you know, I'm sure Keith told you the story about how we, you know, had everything lined up, ready to go, and, you know, our D5 somehow turned into a D3. And so they delivered their, we were completely underpowered. So, I mean, the fact that, you know, you just, you know, bear down and get it done and work through the problems and problem solve. And the fact that we're able to do what we did out there with a, you know, essentially a D3, a little excavator, tractor trailer and a skid. You know, those were, I think for all of us, it was the fact that we were able to do it with so little, I think was, you know, and that was what we set out to do, right? We didn't want to overcomplicate it or make a big production out of it. We just wanted to, you know, get into the sandbox, so to speak, and start creating fun, interesting golf. And, you know, when we completed it and we walked away, I feel like we achieved that goal. So that was the most, I think, rewarding aspect of that project.
Yeah, I loved it. I'd recommend everybody that is in Orlando, you know, especially if you're down there for business, like, it's great to go out there and play as the sun's going down. You can get around in, you know, an hour and 20 minutes. And it's fun.
I think
golf.
That's so key too, right? It's affordable. Yeah. Right? It's not going to cost you an arm and a leg. It's inclusive. You can just show up. You don't have to necessarily plan in advance or make tee times. You know, they're very accommodating. And you know, it's just fun. Urban golf, it's you know, and on the same kind of thread, one of the more rewarding things too is when we, you know, going back there and hanging out on the patio, I just love sitting there and watching people either putt on nine or teeing off on one. And I remember seeing a group of seniors, they must have been in their 80s, a foursome, heckling each other on the first tee and hitting it down and taking off and starting their round, and right behind them was he must have been like four, maybe five, his first time on a golf course with his dad. And the dad was telling us that he'd been, you know, hitting balls on the range for, you know, practicing for this moment. And the kid was his first time on a, you know, quote unquote, real size golf course is what the kid said. And his dad caddied for him. And so now you have this, you know, 4-year-old or 5-year-old following a foursome of 85-year-olds and everything in between, and each one of them are, you know, experiencing the golf course and having a, you know, enjoying it on their own level, which I think for us was very rewarding.
Yeah, I can only imagine. It's got to be really cool just to watch people play all that, like your course and everything. So I'm curious, you know, with the, you know, as you're starting to build your, you know, your individual design career, what would you say if you could, you know, what would be a dream project? You know, whether it be a particular area or, a particular type of course, you know, what would you most want to build?
That's an easy one for me. I love surfing. I've traveled quite a bit surfing, and you know, I think there's something connected, you know, whether it's a spiritual thing or just the same type of, I don't know, surfing and golfing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I have similar threads that connect. Mm-hmm. And I would love to do my dream project, and anyone that knows me knows I talk about this all the time, is my surf and turf resort, I call it. I want to find a surf break somewhere in the world that also on the shore has just the perfect landscape for golf. And it'd be cool to combine a, you know, Cabot, Bandon style golf resort where it's about just the golf, right? Not about the amenities and all that. It's about just a great piece of golfing terrain, but also there's a surf break, and the clubhouse acts as the clubhouse for both the surfing, uh-huh, people that are surfing and the people that are golfing. And you know, when there's no waves and it's not pumping out there, you can golf, right? But yeah, when the waves pick up, everyone kind of goes to the surf break. So you kind of have, you know, it's a two amenities at this one resort. And I think if partnering up with a, you know, a professional surfer or something like that to kind of get this off the ground would be a dream job for sure. It would be, you know, I think it would be a hit, because I think there's a lot of, you know, commonalities between surfing and golfing. And I think exploring that with some sort of surf and turf resort, I think would be pretty fun.
Yeah, that's I have never surfed, but I've always been curious and wanted to. So, you know, I you'd need to have like somebody there to teach beginners like myself.
Exactly, and same with the surfers that can surf and
want to golf.
Need lessons golfing, right?
It sounds like
every year I watch the Kapalua. You know, the, what is it? Not Hyundai anymore, whatever that tournament is now, the Champions tournament there at Kapalua.
Uh-huh.
Just watching those guys surfing and the whales breaching and all that kind of stuff. I always get re-inspired every year after watching that golf tournament in Hawaii, as it's snowing outside my here.
I feel like the hang at that spot would be, you know, unparalleled. It would just be the most laid back, you know, low key, no care in the world kind of place.
That's it. Yeah, that's exactly it.
So I'd love to hear a little bit about what you're working on these days. Now that you got Winter Park done, what's in the hopper, and what are you working on now?
Well, I've got a couple irons in the fire with potential projects and some other projects that we're, you know, still continuing to work on, but. Now, I was just hired by a golf club out in Vancouver called Point Grey. And so I'll be their consulting architect, and they want to go forward with a long-range master plan and kind of reassess their club and take, you know, just kind of take a look, a fresh look at it, right? They want to take a look at what their character is or what their genre is, what their identity is. And, you know, there's some trees that need to be addressed, and you know, just overall, just kind of starting from the ground floor, and I'm going to be working with them to help them kind of achieve their goals. And so I'm really looking forward to that, as it's somewhat close to my home. And you know, as I get more into the project, the more I'm learning about the history of Point Grey. It's quite fascinating with just the connection that they have, you know, to St. Andrews and the Golden Age, right? It's a 1920s course, and it was laid out or designed by a golfer named David Ayton, who is, you know, part of this golfing family from St. Andrews. And we discussed this yesterday when his brothers ended up in Chicago golfing there, and David ended up going to Vancouver, and they ended up playing an exhibition match against an Horton Smith and Walter Hagen, and just some really fascinating, tidbits of information that I'm collecting right now, and I'm starting to piece it together. And the more I discover, the kind of more interesting I get. So yeah, I'm really excited about working with Point Grey and exploring a bit more on who this David Ayton guy was and why he came out to Vancouver and designed a golf course.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, with consulting on a project, it's a little different than getting to, sink your teeth in. How do you approach kind of, conveying information and just do you have like a list of things that you want to do and you kind of, go one by one, how do you lay out that master plan for a consulting gig like this?
Well, the consulting is just the beginning part, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm a huge believer in the design process and how that, informs your decisions. Basically, it's, the last thing I want to do is come to a club and be like, I've seen a feature that looked really cool in New York, let's put it here, right? Like, it's not about me, it's not about my tastes or, mm-hmm. Because golf is, it's so subjective that it's, there's no right or wrong answer. There's only, good, better, best sort of thing as far as an answer goes. But, I'm a huge believer in the design process, evidence-based design. My theory is, a well-researched project basically just designs itself, right? So the first thing I do is just kind of amass and collect as much information and data and history and, just take a look at what's there, and then get their wish list, the client's wish list, basically, and say, well, what do you guys want, right? And a lot of times, what it is that they thought they want isn't what they wanted, right? So I don't necessarily ask them what they want. I just kind of ask, who's it for, right? And why? Why do you want it for them? And then I'll try to figure that out, try to get a little bit deeper into the subject for them and kind of let that guide all my decision making. So you kind of get all your, you get goals and objectives and, mm-hmm. and you kind of marry that with your site analysis and your site inventory and then you pull from your own experience and what you've seen and built and then try to marry all those together into a concept design. And hopefully if you've done your research and you got your goals and objectives were all right, your concept design should address the club's needs or desires and then some sort of thing. So that's kind of where I started. It's mm-hmm. basically, and that comes back down to learning that stuff from, the design process is the same for landscape architecture. It's the same for, skyscraper architecture or any sort of designing is kind of, the core of it is always comes from a design process, because that's kind of where you get into the soul of a project and you learn, the why. Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this, right?
Yeah.
And it's not an easy question to always answer.
Yeah. So we got a lot of great Twitter questions, and I wanted to touch on those, on a few of them here. And I think the first one I thought was really interesting. I forgot to write down the person who asked this name. Would destination golf work in the Canadian Sandhills like it does in Nebraska, Sand Valley areas?
Ooh. Let me grab my crystal ball here. Would destination golf work in the Sandhills in Canada? I don't know. Like, it's one of those things where, who would have thought that the Sandhills, in Nebraska would have worked, right? It was a very unlikely story that changed golf course design and architecture and the ethos quite substantially. So it's hard to say no. I think you have to have the right person backing it. The other factor is, and I don't know if this is necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but just the seasonality.
Yep.
We're just that much colder, and you know, their season's just that much shorter. And so it would be a, you know, it would be a tough kind of question from a financial point of view, you know, if that's kind of the angle that the question was a more of a, you know, financially, is it feasible? Or is it, you know, if you're a billionaire and you want to do it and you just want a cool golf course and making money's not the objective, then yeah, it's definitely feasible. And then everything lends it to being a perfect place for golf, except for the fact that there's low population and harsh climate. So, you know, the isolation and the weather are kind of the two factors. But, you know, it's a hard question to answer. I would say so, but depends what your criteria are.
Yeah, I imagine it'd have to be built. And, you know, if you were looking to make money, it'd have to be very minimal and pure golf and built in a way that keeps all the costs really down. Maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like things like even just bringing power out to, you know, like if you're isolated and, then, you know, how do you get power to your resort, right? It's
water.
Or even road access, like all that kind of stuff is, you know, I don't necessarily think the golf is the expensive part. It's the operating of the, mm-hmm. the operations of the club would be, I think, the most challenging thing. I mean, you got to think of things like, okay, we got this beautiful piece of land, it's sand, we can sculpt this, no problem, build a golf course, you know, for a very reasonable price. But then it's like, who's going to maintain it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Who lives out there? You know, where do you get staff? Where do they stay? Right. So there's a lot. There's a lot of questions.
You got to find somebody that loves golf, but also loves cold weather. It's, you know, that'd be probably the tough thing to find, and isolation.
Yeah, there's a. I want to see that job posting.
Yeah.
Love golf. Yeah. I want cold weather. We got a job for you.
And you love isolated. Being by yourself for 9 months of the year.
Yeah, do you like being alone in the dark?
So Patrick Law wants to know, what is the most overlooked feature on a golf course, in your opinion?
Overlooked feature on a golf course. I would say, you know, as weird as this might sound, I would say greens. Mm-hmm. I'd say a lot of guys just don't put enough time into really sculpting or crafting interesting greens, right? It's an interesting thing, because having built many greens for many different people, you know, you kind of learn a lot of different, you know, techniques or reasons or theories and you know, what have you, regarding, you know, putting surfaces and the purpose. And I feel like a lot of golf courses, and this might just be a, you know, a result of things like computer-aided design and, you know, the form follows function, which is probably more of what it is, you know, due to drainage. You know, just greens just have this kind of typical, if we put some undulation in it, you know, we have kind of has it looks like a shape like a potato chip, you know, and we got three exits, right, for water to drain off of it. And, you know, we'll make sure that we're sloping that towards the golfer so it receives the golf ball. And then that's it, right? That's all they really put into it. And, you know, for me, some of the most interesting aspects of seeing cool golf courses around the world, especially quirky golf courses, is how non-typical their putting surfaces are, and how varied they are, and how much variety is in them, and also, you know, how you couldn't build some of those things today because people would say, you know, I don't know, how am I supposed to maintain that, or where, you know, you can't have one exit for water, and mm-hmm. you know, you can't have it sloping away from the golfer, or, you know, whatever it is. But for me, that's kind of the essence of a good golf course, is an interesting, perplexing set of greens that make me really play the course differently the second time I play it after I learn, you know, yeah. where to be, where not to be, and all those kind of things. So I think a lot of guys just don't really put the thought into the greens as much as perhaps they used to, or maybe back in the day it was less of a, there was less criteria, and it was they're a bit more freehand, and you know, the, you know, function's very important, but to design a green based on drainage parameters, well, you're going to get a green that looks like it was designed by drainage parameters, right? So yeah. it's a tough one, but I would say greens, if I had to choose one element on a golf course, I think is, you know, critical to the sport, but is also not getting enough thought.
Yeah, it's interesting. Somebody once said to me, and I'll never forget it, they asked me, have you ever played a great hole that doesn't have a great green? And it's almost impossible to think. So, I mean,
yeah, it's
hard to do. And, you know, like, just like you said, you know, if you're designing just for drainage, like, you risk the variety. Because I was, while you were talking, I was thinking through, you know, my course I think might have the best greens in all of Chicago, and you know, it probably, you know, some of the best in the world, and I thought, you know, the first green slopes away from you, the second green slope, it has a big back to front slope, the next green has a huge right to left slope, you know, the next green is small and narrow and has this left to right slope, and there's just all this variety, and they're simple greens, but you know, no green's like another one on the golf course, and it's just, you know, that course was built in, you know, 1900 or 1899.
Yeah, and you notice it too when you're playing it. Like that's the one thing, you know. When I was out, I think it was about a month ago, I was out on the West Coast there, and I would have played Pasatiempo, and you know, I've heard, obviously read a lot about it and heard, you know, amazing things about the greens, but man, those greens are so good. They're so good. They're so interesting. There's so much variety. And you know, and what I liked about, you know, what was done there, what McKenzie did there, was he took the green shape was kind of dictated by where it sat on the land, sort of thing. So you know, the whole 6,000 square foot oval thing just does not apply to there, because there's some narrow ones that kind of snake or zigzag or kind of have an S shape, because or even if it's, you know, super wide but not deep, right? It's a you know, and it was all a product of him fitting a green into a particular area, but then using that area as the inspiration for what the green does, sort of thing, you know. So it's kind of like he just really masterfully put some amazing greens, and they just fit the site so well. And I think, you know, a place like that, I think, wouldn't be half the golf course without the greens that they're blessed with. So I think, you know, I think really, you know, looking at greens from different perspectives, you know, like you mentioned, you know, whether it's the slope, it's sloping towards you, or left to right, right to left, back to front, you know, that kind of thing, but also the shape of the green.
Yep.
Right? The you know, I think that's also something that's overlooked, and you know, I don't know why. Maybe it has something to do with it's easier to mow with a triplex, or it's the most economical to build, or it's a standard that somehow seeped into the golf construction or design world. But you know, I'm a huge fan of oddly shaped greens, like, yeah, you know, shaped in the, like, an L or an S or a, you know, an E, you know, like those E green, you know, those are the kinds of greens that I find the most fascinating, and you know, Pasatiempo, I think, just did it beautifully.
Yeah, that's on my bucket list of places to go see. So Allie Phillip wants to know your top three Stanley Thompson courses. Man of the hour.
Yeah, well, I have to go with Banff as number one. Uh-huh. You know, I've been very lucky to golf that many times, and every time I golf it, I just learn something new. about the place. And
is that the course that you first started working maintenance on?
No, I worked maintenance at Stewart Creek, which was, that was actually the golf course that I helped survey.
Okay.
It was kind of weird. I surveyed, then helped grow it in, and then maintained it.
Sorry to interrupt, but you're...
No, that's fine. Stanley Thompson. Yeah, no, I have to go with Banff. It's timeless. It's obviously the... You know, the scenery is spectacular, but the only shame is the routing has kind of been mangled with them introducing the new clubhouse back in the 80s, I think it was, or late 70s, or no, it was early 80s, and they kind of injected the clubhouse on the fourth hole, which should have been the fourth hole, which is now the first. And this goes back to our conversation about flow, ebbs and flow, kind mm-hmm. of how the course plays from a golfer's experience perspective. They've kind of they've changed that. They've altered it. The DNA of the routing has been altered, and you notice it, right? Because it was a nine out, nine in routing, which was super cool for a mountain course. But the Devil's Cauldron was kind of at the end of the at the turn point, and it was an anticipation factor. And, there's all these kind of emotions at play that he did so well. And it's the opening tee shot over Spray River from on top of this cliff, and it's just like, man, that would have been such a good golf course when it had first opened back in the day. So I'm a huge Banff Springs fan. I could go on and on about it. Highland Links, definitely second. The routing is phenomenal. Like Stanley Thompson, I thought, was a genius when it came to that, and he was able to get you from the coast up into the hills, up into the mountains, into the valleys, and then back down to the coast. And there's a lot of elevation that you climb, but you just don't notice it. And some fantastic golf holes, some fantastic fairway contours. I love the fairway contouring out there, just the old world rustic dimple, it just has so much character, and so does Cape Breton in general. So it's like it just fits its environment just beautifully. And then I would say I go with Jasper. Gotta go with the locals, the local courses. Jasper is just such a it's a little bit different than Banff. It doesn't have the mountains just looming over you, and it doesn't feel like you can hit your golf ball off the cliff sort of thing, but it just has this just real subtle and artfully routed and interesting golf holes that is just it's just pleasant, right? So I would say those are my three, but there's more obscure one. I mean, Capilano's fantastic. I was able to play that a week or two ago, and once again, the routing's phenomenal. He's able to get you all the way down the hill. You got these cool, it's kind of like an urban kind of feel to it when you're looking at the skyline of Vancouver. It's got these big old, stumps that are kind of scattered everywhere from when they built the place, and it's got a neat character to it. But what other Stanley Thompson there's a course in Kenora, which is in Ontario, right on the Manitoba-Ontario border, and it's a Stanley Thompson track, and it's I like to think it's kind of like Yale. It's kind of built on rock, right? And they weren't able to blast all the rock away, and so they kind of just followed the contours of the bedrock, and had some really cool, bold, big undulations, big hogback flat, fairways, and just greens tucked around the property, and just has this really neat feel to it. And I don't think a lot of people played it, but Kenora Golf Club is, whenever I'm out in that area, that's kind of one of, at Melhurst, are the first two golf courses that I go play. So, lots of good Stanley Thompson tracks up here.
Yeah, and for Americans, there's, I know Cleveland's got a public access one called Sleepy Hollow, I think. It's a Stanley Thompson. It's supposed to be really good, and I've actually heard that there's a Stanley Thompson down in Florida, in like the Jacksonville area, that refuses to, it keeps saying it's a Donald Ross and not a Stanley Thompson because they think the value of having a Ross is greater than having a Thompson, even though it would be a rarity in the U.S. to have a Stanley Thompson designed golf course.
There's a bunch actually in the Ohio area.
Yeah,
I think there's several. Yeah.
We might need to do a profile on him one of these days.
He's a fascinating character. I mean, like all these guys, as you read more and more about them, but he was, whiskey drinking, cigar smoking, died penniless, but, was just a remarkable, human who, pioneered a lot of things in golf course architecture that I think, perhaps get overlooked. So that would be an interesting profile for you to do.
Yeah, I think it's also so cool that he grew up caddying at Toronto Golf Club, which was like Harry Colt's first Canadian design and, Canada's first like preeminent golf course.
It makes you wonder, eh? Like, I've always wondered about that because there was no precedent back then, really, for routing. I mean, you could go over to the British Isles and that's where all those guys kind of learned, some of the craft, but there was nothing really on routing, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Colt wrote about routing and he kind of pioneered a lot of the returning nines and the way you can triangulate and loop golf holes and just the economics of smart routing and why, but makes you wonder if Stanley met Colt at any point and mm-hmm. talked, because how does someone go about being new to a brand new industry, right? Let alone new to a profession, but like there was no one else doing it and get so many things right out of the gate, especially with routing, right? Makes you wonder where he picked, if maybe he was just a natural at it and is a very intuitive thing for him, or maybe he had some contact with someone like Colt Well, in Toronto. And I'm just conspiracy theory right now, but I don't know, that's always boggled me, how someone comes out of the gate and gets so much right without ever mm-hmm. having the failures to learn off of, right? He did a lot of good golf courses early on in his career, and some major ones too, where he really pioneered things.
I mean, you have to think at the bare minimum that he looked at Toronto Golf and used so much of what he learned from walking around there in his first design, like it, at the very least. And you have to imagine, you could have definitely foresee him, either maybe he caddied for Colt and they talked to, who knows. There's
who knows.
Yeah,
I mean, he was a good golfer, and I'm sure that helped, but. I don't necessarily think being a good golfer necessarily translates into knowing how to route a golf course,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I wouldn't know what I was doing if you handed me a topography map. So, you've been more than generous with your time. We'll get you out of here on our overrated, underrated. It's a fried egg podcast tradition here. So we've got a couple teed up for you.
And, okay.
Playoff hockey.
Oh, underrated. Best hockey on the planet. So, actually, after World Juniors. I'll preface with that.
So, who's your horse in the race this year?
Oh, Edmonton's going all the way. After Calgary's disappointing loss last night, I am now fully on Edmonton and huge fan of McDavid. And I just love the relentless young guns. Edmonton is just such a 100% every shift type team, and no giving up, and all of the stuff I love about hockey, Edmonton's doing right now. So, and playoff hockey, it just accentuates all that. So yeah, Canada's year this year. It was a disappointing one last year with not having anyone in there, but this year we got a few teams that could go all the way.
Yeah, I think Edmonton's a lot like my Blackhawks 10 years ago. Lots of young talent and hungry talent, and they just go at it, hoping for a miracle for my Hawks that are now down 3-0.
But yeah, you're gonna need one.
Yeah. If any team can do it, they can. But yeah. we'll see. Template holes.
Man, it's bizarre. I don't know. I've never heard so much conversations about template holes than I have in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna have to go with overrated, just because it's you know, it's not like it's kind of old news.
Yeah.
I mean, they're fundamentally, they're sound for golf. You know, that's why they, you know, so prolific in architecture. But you know, I think taking template holes and using them as inspiration and adapting them and tweaking them, I think that's the important thing of template holes, not necessarily replicating them, if you know what I mean. It's so I don't know. I'm gonna go overrated.
Yeah, I like the idea of the twist. You know, I came up, mm-hmm. I was writing something about the double plateau, and I came up with an idea for one. I call it the double plat bowl, where you've got the front two, you know, you've got the one at ground level, and then you've got the one raised on the left, or whatever. You could flip flop those, but then the back one is a punch bowl.
That's kind of what I did for the Lido Prize. Basically, the punch bowl was obscured by a big blow-up bunker on the left, but then on the right you had full visual, but it was a tricky putt to get it back there because of the plateau. So you had to choose whether you're going to kind of put the faith in your iron shot and just kind of, you know, land it in the punch bowl and you know, a bit of a throwback to, you know, the Dell hole in Ireland sort of thing, where you just swing it and the anticipation of going around to see where it actually is, you know, or you played it kind of more strategically, where you, you know, knock your ball and you keep it in sight, and then you put the premium on your lag putt sort of thing. So
yeah, or you could try and run it in there. You know, it'd be cool. I think. And then you use that bunker slope, right, as the kind of punch bowl. That's hey, great minds.
Yeah. Nature did a similar thing. What you're talking about, it's called a platypus.
Platypus.
Just cramming these two things together, building a chimera of sorts.
Yeah, seriously, I haven't thought about a platypus since like grade school. So we're going to go with a Canadian hero here, Mike Weir.
Oh, man. You know, winning the Masters, you know, I think for anyone that's won the Masters, I think you have to say they've made an impact on golf. So, and he certainly did up here in Canada. I mean, Canada doesn't really have any megastars, whatever you call it, PGA golf, just a, you know, a guy that we've all kind of, we don't have our Rory McIlroy, you know, yet.
Yeah.
So he was kind of that, I suppose, and so I would say underrated. I mean, he was, when in his prime, he was good.
Yeah, I mean, I think there has to be, like you see, there's a lot of great Canadian players now. I asked I had a Canadian on my last podcast who's a PGA Tour writer, Adam Sarson, and I asked him if he thought there was a Mike Weir effect in Canada, and he said that he thinks so. I think he meant a lot to that country, and I would agree that he's underrated, you know. And then final one here, Pete Dye.
I would say underrated because of what he did for golf course architecture, right? He, you know, he blazed the trail. He was the guy that kind of started stirring the pot and started creating golf courses and started implementing ideas as controversial as they may be. You know, he evoked emotion out of people. He got golf course architecture kind of out of the rut, I guess you'd call it, or, you know, kind of pulled it out of its rut and you know, went for it and you know, started building architecturally sound golf courses and golf holes that, you know, are very, you know, some, there might be a lot of controversy around some of them and all that, but I mean, without putting yourself out there, without taking that risk or that leap, you know, we're all going to just be doing the same thing and just kind of, you know, regurgitating the same golf courses all over, you know, over and over. And it's just something I think that he kind of took and shook the hornet's nest and got people inspired and got people talking about golf and golf course architecture and, you know, started doing all these, you know, yeah, amazing things as far as building, you know, like some, you know, like the Island Green. I mean, like that, you know, he went and did it. And so I would say he's underrated for what he did for golf course architecture. And I think history is going to look back upon it as that being a defining moment, right, in the lineage of golf course architecture. Because, I mean, you just look at the guys who were inspired or preceded him, right?
Yeah.
It's an amazing list of, you know, whether it's Doak or Bill Coor or Rod Whitman, right? These guys are all kind of students of the Pete Dye era, and golf is better for it. So
yeah, I would agree. I think the mentorship aspect of it is one piece that often goes overlooked. You know, he ushered in the big change. So
yeah,
I'm on the same boat as you there. So. But Riley, I really appreciate the time, and it was fun having you on, and we'll have to do it again sometime. For those that, you know, wanna follow Riley, he's pretty active on social media. I think it's at Integrative Golf on both Instagram and Twitter, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Just you could search Riley Johns too. But Riley, thanks so much for the time, and we'll look forward to. To watching what's next for you.
Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Have fun.